Welcome to the TaxCast. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
They control this thing. They just seem to be getting away with being the guardians of commerce when they're basically a bunch of tax cheating facilitators.
The big four accountancy firms. Are they in fact more like the big one? And should they be broken up? But first, here's the Tax Justice News headlines for this month. In the United States, Facebook could have to pay an extra $5 billion tax bill after an investigation into how it's been shifting its profits through Ireland. Apparently, Facebook showed contempt throughout the process towards the US tax authorities. Also in the United States, presidential hopeful Donald Trump has promised the biggest tax revolution since Ronald Reagan, proposing a cut in US corporate taxes from 35% to 15%, as if the big companies ever actually paid 35%. Indonesia's also considering a corporate tax cut from 25% to 17%, matching the UK, until they drop it again, that is, which they've already said they will, to 15%. Perhaps they should all go and study the tax haven of Jersey, which went all the way down to 0% and went bust. In Europe, the LuxLeaks scandal revealed the cosy deals struck in secret between multinational companies, accountancy firms and the Luxembourg tax authorities, some of which have been since found to be breaking EU state aid and fair competition rules. Ironically, it was public-spirited whistleblowers Antoine Deltour and Raphael Allais who were dragged through the courts. They avoided jail time and were given suspended sentences. The Luxembourg prosecutors now appealed against those verdicts. They're likely to be back in court by the end of this year. Former European Union Commission President Barroso is now chairman of Goldman Sachs, which played a central role in the 2008 crisis. Campaigners are again calling for a ban for former commissioners of at least 3 years from any job that provokes a conflict of interest. HSBC Bank's profits have nosedived 29% in the first half of this financial year. They've admitted they still haven't strengthened their processes to protect against financial crime, despite an order to do so from a US regulator back in 2010. They've also been hit by requests from regulators all over the world for information about its part in its dealings with Mossack Fonseca, the law firm exposed in the Panama Papers leak. The bank's still under investigation as well for alleged tax avoidance activities by its Swiss branch. And finally, some interesting Panama Papers fallout. Iceland is holding early elections as a result of their prime minister stepping down after being disgraced by the Panama Papers scandal. And it looks like the Pirate Party, so-called Radical Democrats, may be elected. Their manifesto includes promises on government transparency, a new constitution, and asylum for whistleblower Edward Snowden. So that could be interesting. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, this month in Britain, the Duke of Westminster died, meaning his son, who's now the 7th Duke of Westminster, the 25-year-old Hugh Grosvenor, is now the heir to a legacy of more than £9 billion. So lucky him. And because this money's in a series of trusts, he's not going to have to pay the usual 40% inheritance tax, which ordinary people who inherit money pay when both their parents die, assuming their family's got any money. And this might sound a bit like a very weirdly British affair, but the Grosvenor family is intricately tied up with lawmaking that's actually formed the basis of legal justification for tax avoidance ever since. And that's not just in Britain, but in many jurisdictions around the world, right? So there's a history here that's worth exploring.
Yep, that's right. The very name, Duke of Westminster, is famous in tax law around the world because of a ruling that came out of the House of Lords in Britain in 1936, and that was to do with tax avoidance. And that ruling doesn't just apply in Britain, it applies to common law countries around the entire world and has also been adopted about tax laws in many other countries. When I was a kind of a rookie working in the tax avoidance industry in the 1980s and 1990s, all the lawyers And all of the accountants that I worked with referred to the Duke of Westminster ruling as the basis on which they could put together these elaborate structures. So it's very important. And that ruling, which came out from, the head of that commission back in 1936, Lord Tomlin, said, crucially, every man is entitled, if he can, to order his affairs so that the tax attaching under the appropriate acts is less than it otherwise would be. And if he succeeds in ordering them so as to secure this result, then, however unappreciative the commissioners of Inland Revenue or his fellow taxpayers may be of his ingenuity, he cannot be compelled to pay an increased tax. Now, that's a little bit legal, but it's been interpreted as a green light to tax avoidance. So the Duke of Westminster family is very deeply embedded in international law on tax avoidance. And remember, it isn't only inheritance taxes in this case, because the Duke of Westminster's fortune is largely held in the form of real estate in London and elsewhere. And real estate in Britain is massively undertaxed. There's no land value taxes, there are no foncier rates. The property tax system in the United Kingdom is highly regressive and punishes small house owners and largely lets off the big property owners. So this is a family that's embedded its fortune in tax avoidance. And that's why it's of such great interest to the tax justice community, not just in Britain, but around the world, because the Duke of Westminster, having inherited $9 billion, will probably continue to concentrate more and more wealth and pay less and less tax in the coming decades. And I think this is symptomatic of what's happened, not just in the British economy, but in the whole global economy. The rich have been able to organise their affairs using trusts and foundations and similar structures in such a way that they don't pay any tax on their wealth.
Right, and this is why the issue of trusts, as we keep saying on the TaxCast, really must be addressed, and not only the anonymous ownership of companies. And I should explain the benefits of trusts are that they don't actually form part of somebody's estate. In a discretionary trust, you can pick a whole list of beneficiaries which the trustees can choose to appoint the benefits to, and you can't point any finger to a potential beneficiary and say, that's your money. So this way the money kind of stays in a trust and sort of goes on from generation to generation with nobody paying tax on it.
That is the absolutely crucial issue here. It goes from generation to generation without any tax being paid for it, because these trusts live on in perpetuity. A trust is nothing more than a legal agreement. It's not made public, it's not required to put any financial statements onto public record. These are very private and secretive arrangements, and they can continue in perpetuity. And that means that a huge amount of assets are not only held undisclosed from the public, so that we have no idea how much wealth these families actually have, and therefore no way of taxing them, but it means that a huge volume of wealth across the world is now held through trusts and foundations. Inequality as a result is much, much worse than the official statistics suggest, because the official statistics don't include the value of assets held in trusts. And yet families like the Grosvenor family continue to use them and will continue to use them in perpetuity.
Right, well, let's go to the United States now. And it seems unconnected, but actually it may not be, because all of the finance sector players are making a lot of money out of trusts. And in the United States, there's been a very interesting development. The world's biggest banks have actually endorsed ending anonymous shell companies. Supposedly, they've seen the error of their ways. I mean, I'm talking about banks like the Bank of America, Citibank, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo. They've all thrown their support behind a bipartisan Incorporation Transparency and Law Enforcement Assistance Act, which we've reported on before on the TaxCast. Now, this support is obviously welcome, but would it be unduly cynical to say that there's perhaps more business to be had from transferring assets over to trusts rather than fighting to maintain secrecy around company ownership?
Right, look, the bill, the Incorporation Transparency and Law Enforcement Assistance Act is a bipartisan act. It has strong support within the House. And the fact that the Clearinghouse Association, which is the kind of umbrella organization of the big United States banks, has their support is good news. And of course, banks have a reason for wanting to support this because they have a huge legal requirement under existing anti-money laundering and drug and terrorist financing legislation to do due diligence, to find out who are the beneficial owners of these offshore companies. So they have an interest because it'll help them cut down their costs and it'll get them out of the firing line. But the key question, as you suggest, is how deep will this go? Will this now get them off the hook when it comes to identifying beneficial owners? Because they can then say, look, this Delaware registered company belongs to a trust set up in Bermuda and we've done our job, so they're off the hook. Or will they be required to go all the way and say, this company registered in Delaware belongs to a trust in Bermuda and the beneficiaries of this trust in Bermuda are actually resident in New York State? And that's not clear. And for that reason, that lack of clarity is probably going to leave the barn door open for further shenanigans. At this stage, I don't want to be too cynical. I wanted to say, well, this is a welcome step forward, but we're not there yet. We need to have a full commitment to transparency at every single level. Because without that, without closing off every single loophole when it comes to secrecy, then it actually is not going to be worth the paper it's written on.
Right, OK. Let's take a quick look at Panama and what's been going on there this month. Since April and the Panama Papers scandal broke and kind of caught them with their pants down, along with the law firm Mossack Fonseca and the close links between the president and the financial services industry, the Panamanian government set up a transparency commission and they appointed, among others, the US economist and Professor Joseph Stiglitz and US Professor Mark Piaf to this commission. And apparently things went downhill very quickly from there. And they both resigned this month because they say the Panamanian government wouldn't agree to making the findings of the commission public. So the Transparency Commission wasn't going to be transparent.
It's farcical, but unfortunately very serious, because this Transparency Commission, set up in the wake of the Panama scandal, the Panama Papers scandal, with strong support, was the Panamanian response to huge public pressure to clear up their act. And let's remember, although Panama isn't a huge player in the overall thing, they have a secrecy score of 72 out of 100 in the Financial Secrecy Index, and therefore they are a highly secretive jurisdiction and a non-cooperative jurisdiction. So under international pressure, they established this commission, and within a matter of weeks, things started to go pear-shaped. And because neither Stiglitz nor Piaf could get the necessary assurances from the Panamanian government, they've now walked away saying we're not happy with this process. More deeply, I think we need to recognise that Panama's business model has been very deeply based upon secrecy. They don't actually have much of a legitimate financial services role to play in the globalised economy. So if they do go down the route of becoming much more transparent, as they promised, they're going to lose a great deal of business, which means a large number of American banks, and by which I mean United States banks and United States law offices and accounting firms, will have to pack up their bags and leave Panama City. So a great deal is at stake around this. At this stage, all we can say is that the Panamanian government seemed to engage in a public relations exercise to impress the rest of the world that they were taking effective action, and their bluff has been called by Joseph Stiglitz and his colleagues.
Right, and we should point out as well that the US-American banks doing business there, they were not really interested in attracting US citizens' money, of course. They were about attracting Latin American elite money. That's why they were there.
That's absolutely correct. Panama has not really been a major offshore tax haven for United States citizens. They have their own tax havens in places like Delaware and Nevada and so on, where they can do their secrecy stuff. Generally, when they wanted to move offshore outside the United States entirely, they've used Cayman and Bermuda because they're more familiar and a little bit more comfortable using British jurisdictions. But Panama was always used by US banks to attract dirty money flows out of Latin America into the United States, with a great deal of tacit support from the United States government.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. The big four accountancy firms are the architects of so many tax scandals we've covered on the TaxCast. I'm talking about Deloitte, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young and KPMG. But somehow, they always seem to manage to escape the spotlight and the attention's focused instead on their wealthy clients, corporations, or on the governments offering them silly tax rates, depriving other nations of tax revenue. So this month, we're going to take a closer look at the Big Four and the threat they pose to all of us and to the global economy.
I think, frankly, the Big Four have already sown the seeds of their own destruction. Revenue bases are dropping and people are being affected. Awareness is growing.
This is George Rosvani. He calls himself a tax ethicist, and he's writing a series of books on corporate tax ethics. I'll give you the details later. What you're about to hear from him on the Big Four accountancy firms is based on his personal experience.
I've probably had interactions with the Big Four for the last 32 years on virtually every day of my professional career. Partners, bosses, friends, tennis partners, ski partners, lunch buddies, and I've worked with all the major firms, well, the four firms certainly, in terms of client relationships, but I worked in three of the four in terms of my professional life. So I've had a very, very deep involvement with the Big Four over an enormous period of time.
So, George, you liken the way your former colleagues work and the way the Big Four accountancy firms are structured to the mafia. Tell us about that.
Well, it's really looking at the way the organised crime gangs work, the style in terms of how they protect their reputation. A partner's like a godfather. He's untouchable. He's seen as the master of all and all powerful. And around him, he's got a numbers of teams, a number of layers, which are quite interesting. The number of layers of six in the Big Four accounting firms matches the six levels in the mafia, if you look through the mafia hierarchies.
Right, so six levels: partner, director, senior manager, manager, senior associate and associate. And in the mafia, you've got the boss, of course, his chief advisor, the underboss, the captain or lieutenant of a division that reports back to him, then the soldiers, and last of all, the associates.
Yes, it is extremely interesting. But they also operate under a code of a silence as well. They don't like disclosing anything, which again follows the mafia trends. The reputation, the power, the silence, the structure, these are all very similar to the mafia operations. I look at the five New York crime families. Their structure hasn't altered much in 85 years since 1930. Once an organisation begins to threaten democracy, something needs to be done. What could happen is essentially everything's run out of the Big Four in terms of commerce from end to end.
George Rosvani estimates the Big Four accountancy firms are responsible for losses to governments of at least $1 trillion US dollars in tax revenues a year.
They rely, particularly ones that are more aggressive, tend to rely in burying the scheme or the structure somewhere so that the revenue never identified. So the non-disclosure actually plays a key part in success, as it were, of these schemes. So if you make it complex enough and bury it deep enough, it's very hard to find. And what is the law? If, for example, you distort the law of a tax haven by saying, look, we're going to bring all this revenue through you, here's your tax law, and the taxes are diverted from other countries, it may be technically legal, but is it ethically right that this revenue should be taken from other countries? So legal, I mean, there's all sorts of crimes which were once completely legal. I mean, murder was once legal, rape was once legal, but of course society moved on and said, well, that's not right, we're going to make it a crime.
These firms know some of their corporate tax avoidance schemes are barely legal. One former senior PricewaterhouseCoopers employee told the British Parliament's Public Accounts Committee not so long ago that the firms sold tax avoidance schemes to clients with a 75% risk of it being deemed unlawful, should it ever be challenged in court. The other three firms have admitted to selling schemes they believed only had a 50% chance of being upheld in court. They do that because they know court, at least for their big clients, is very unlikely to happen.
Well, they've got the game sewn up. The accounting standard setting board here is loaded with people from the Big Four. Basically, they control this thing. They just seem to be getting away with being the guardians of commerce when they're basically a bunch of tax cheating facilitators.
Michael West is an award-winning investigative economics journalist. He's been on the trail of the Big Four for years. They don't like him very much.
The issue is really, what is legal and what's not legal? Well, until the government has dragged somebody through the courts without a settlement but won the case, at the end of the day, after the end of many years, after the end of appeals, even appeals to the High Court, after the full bench of the Federal Court, you know, we're talking many millions of dollars, and they finally get a judgment in their favour, then and only then can it be deemed to be illegal. Now, it never gets that far because there's a settlement at some point, or, as is more likely, tax office people. The ATO just doesn't even take them to court because it knows that it'll be mired in court forever. You know, the Big Four are beyond the law. And they, who else can call straight into the tax office and have a chat with people? I mean, there's secondments running between the Big Four and the Treasury and other government departments. The corporate regulator is extremely close to the Big Four. Now, they've infiltrated governments at every level all around the world. This is the issue. They also earn absolutely supercharged fees from government. They all are significant political donors to both sides of politics.
And it's interesting, isn't it, too, that this huge data leak from the Panama Papers earlier this year, once again, the Big Four and their part in it all just seems to have gone below the radar.
If you look at the Panama Papers stuff, everybody points the bone at Mossack Fonseca. But who are the auditors of all these companies? Who's BHP's auditor, for instance? They were involved in Mossack Fonseca. Putin's banks were involved in Mossack Fonseca. And one of Putin's banks is audited by PwC. These guys are in the thick of it. They're everywhere you look. LuxLeaks, only PwC has been busted. But as I understand it, the other three are there too. You know, perverting national laws, in this case Luxembourg, in order to gain an advantage for their clients. So the next leg of the public education revolution is who are the culprits? And the culprits are the big blue chip goody two shoes of international commerce. It's a marvel of public relations that these guys have been able to promote themselves as good guys. The system is broken. The system has allowed these four very powerful, too big to fail institutions to basically manipulate international commerce.
It gets worse. Michael's asked all of the Big Four something they really ought to know, but don't, or at least they didn't want to discuss it when he called them.
Just by the way, who audits your firm? I mean, being auditors and being communications people, indeed, they should know this. And of course, the responses were as if they'd never even considered that they should be audited. Came as quite a shock, I think, to all of them. And they all responded variously by saying, we'll get back to you, or I'm not sure, but I'm not sure if we are audited. Another one ummed and ahed for an extended period of time. Another one, there was stony silence.
Michael has yet to get any answers on that. George Rosvani doesn't know the answer either, even after working with and for the Big Four at senior levels for decades. He says insurance arrangements aren't disclosed even internally.
Well, there's no global regulator. We can't get any information on who actually audits the Big Four. Do they self-audit or do they have another accounting firm do it? If you actually do your own audits, how can it be said to be legitimate? I'm also a bit curious as to what the insurance arrangements are, because it makes a lot of sense for that nature of business to have a common insurance pool. But if they did have a common insurance pool, say in the Bahamas, that effectively would be one firm. So they've got one firm dominating, because of the financial links, one firm basically auditing 98% of the world.
Right, because the Big Four, just four firms, audit 98% of corporations with a turnover of $1 billion or more. And so you're saying that for all we know, with these opaque partnership structures and possibly shared offshore insurance arrangements, the Big Four could well be more like the Big One.
Correct. The Big One. Big Brother. When you look at the penetration of the Big One into all levels of government, and the range of services offered, I mean, really what they're doing is really taking over the operation of companies by stealth. I mean, the issue with that is that companies are then subject to the risk management structures of the big four accounting firms and not their own structures, which creates all sorts of problems.
Michael West.
It's reasonably common knowledge, though not established as a matter of fact, that they have captive insurers somewhere in the Caribbean. So that means that they're insuring themselves. But the interesting thing would be if they actually insure each other as well, which would really make them the big one. I'm not being a conspiracy theorist here. I put this question to them. If they refuse to answer it, then we could speculate on it. It's as simple as that. And if they want to come out and they say, yes, we're insured and this is our insurer, and no, it has nothing to do with any of the other firms, well, good on them. They can do that. It's free speech. They're able to come out and deny that they're the big one. But of course, they haven't done that yet, have they?
And George, it's the desire to retain that secrecy that stops the big four accountancy firms from a public listing on the share market, you say, because that would mean more transparency in terms of their operations and their accounts, right?
Oh, absolutely. If they were listed, it'd be in the range of $100 to $150 billion in a capital raising.
That's a lot of money to turn down, isn't it? And in your view, the big four represent such a threat to the global economy, they need to be broken up. Not only the big four firms themselves, but the accounting and the tax functions within each firm should be split up too, according to you. So we'd end up with 8 international audit firms and 8 international tax firms.
Yes, this is well overdue. The oil industry, the banking industry, and other organisations have been split up well before this. But 4 organisations dominating 98% of global commerce as auditors is well past its use by date. I don't think any industry has come even close to this. The smartest thing to do, really, for the big four would be to accept that this structure is archaic, doesn't really work anymore because it's a conflict situation, and the world doesn't like it. It would be easier for the firms themselves to agree to split themselves up, but it can be forced through regulatory action by having each country agree through international cooperation to split or cause a split. And it happens. I mean, organisations are split. It's remarkably simple. There's specialists around who have organised mergers of firms, but, you know, demergers, you know, it's just a reversal of process. It can be done. And really, in a sense, Big Four should welcome such a change because it creates greater integrity to the process, and it also creates greater competition. These two concepts are very, very important, I think, in commerce.
Right, but as we've seen time and time again, the captains of commerce at the top of the tree don't tend to like the idea of fair competition. Michael West.
I don't think there's any doubt these guys are the most powerful institutions in the world. I think they must accept that this is coming. They're not at that stage, but of course they will have to get to that stage because, as George says, it's inevitable that there will be more scrutiny on them. I mean, what's the next LuxLeaks? Panama Papers. When's that going to happen? Not only are we giving them all these millions in government contracts for doing scoping studies and various things, but they're costing taxpayers a hell of a lot, and it will be really interesting to see what their own tax arrangements are. I agree, George, it will happen, and it's going to be ugly. People like me, they'll be trying to stub out. There's no doubt about that. It will happen, it's just a matter of time.
Interestingly, PricewaterhouseCoopers is currently facing 3 legal actions in the United States for allegedly negligent audits for clients relating to the financial crisis back in 2008. Just one of these cases is a potential knockout blow for PricewaterhouseCoopers. The plaintiffs are hoping to recover $5.5 billion in damages. That's all we've got time for. You can read Michael West's articles and subscribe to them too on www.michaelwest.com.au. To find out more about George Rosvani's book, Corporate Tax Ethics, A Journey for Mankind, go to www.thepentologybook.com.au. I also highly recommend Austin Mitchell and Prem Seeker's monograph, which you can download for free, The Pinstripe Mafia, How Accountancy Firms Destroy Societies. Do a search online for that. Well worth it. Bye for now. We'll be back next month.